The crowd applauded. Mr. Thompson sat motionless, with his face held self-consciously stiff. Dr. Stadler felt certain that this small-time shyster had had as little to do with the project as any of the movie usher attendants, that he possessed neither the mind nor the initiative, nor even the sufficient degree of malice to cause a new gopher trap to be brought into the world, that he too was only the pawn of a silent machine, a machine that had no center, no leader, no direction, a machine that had not been set in motion by Dr. Ferris or Wesley Mooch, or any of the cowed creatures in the grandstands, or any of the creatures behind the scenes. An impersonal, unthinking, unembodied machine, of which none was the driver, and all were the pawns, each to the degree of his evil. Dr. Stadler gripped the edge of the bench. He felt a desire to leap to his feet and run. "As to the function and the purpose of the sound ray, I shall say nothing. I shall let it speak for itself. You will now see it work. When Dr. Blodgett pulls the levers of the xylophone, I suggest that you keep your eyes on the target, which is that farmhouse 2 miles away. There will be nothing else to see. The ray itself is invisible. It has long been conceded by all progressive thinkers that there are no entities, only actions, and no values, only consequences. Now, ladies and gentlemen, you will see the action and the consequences of the Thompson harmonizer." Dr. Ferris bowed, walked slowly away from the microphone, and came to take his seat on the bench beside Dr. Stadler. A youngish, fattish kind of man took his stand by the switchboard and raised his eyes expectantly toward Mr. Thompson. Mr. Thompson looked blankly bewildered for an instant, as if something had slipped his mind, until Wesley Mooch leaned over and whispered some word into his ear. "Contact," said Mr. Thompson loudly. Dr. Stadler could not bear to watch the graceful, undulating, effeminate motion of Dr. Blodgett's hand as it pulled the first lever of the switchboard, then the next. He raised his field glasses and looked at the farmhouse. In the instant when he focused his lens, a goat was pulling at its chain, reaching placidly for a tall, dry thistle. In the next instant, the goat rose into the air, upturned, its legs stretching upward and jerking, then fell into a gray pile made of 7 goats in convulsions. By the time Dr. Stadler believed it, the pile was motionless, except for 1 beast's leg sticking out of the mass, stiff as a rod and shaking as in a strong wind. The farmhouse tore into strips of clapboard and went down, followed by a geyser of the bricks of its chimney. The tractor vanished into a pancake. The water tower cracked, and its shreds hit the ground while its wheel was still describing a long curve through the air as of its own leisurely volition. The steel beams and girders of the solid new trestle collapsed like a structure of matchsticks under the breath of a sigh. It was so swift, so uncontested, so simple, that Dr. Stadler felt no horror. He felt nothing. It was not the reality he had known. It was the realm of a child's nightmare where material objects could be dissolved by means of a single malevolent wish. He moved the field glasses from his eyes. He was looking at an empty prairie. There was no farm. There was nothing in the distance except a darkish strip that looked like the shadow of a cloud. A single high, thin scream rose from the tiers behind him as some women fainted. He wondered why she should scream so long after the fact. And then he realized that the time elapsed since the touch of the first lever was not a full minute. He raised his field glasses again, almost as if he were suddenly hoping that the cloud shadow would be all he would see. But the material objects were still there. They were a mount of refuse. He moved his glasses over the wreckage. In a moment, he realized that he was looking for the kid. He could not find it. There was nothing but a pile of gray fur. When he lowered the glasses and turned, he found Dr. Ferris looking at him. He felt certain that through the whole of the test, it was not the target, it was his face that Ferris had watched, as if to see whether he, Robert Stadler, could withstand the ray. "That's all there is to it," the fattish Dr. Blodgett announced through the microphone in the ingratiating sales tone of a department store floor walker. "There is no nail or rivet remaining in the frame of the structures, and there is no blood vessel left unbroken in the bodies of the animals." The crowd was rustling with jerky movements and high-pitched whispers, People were looking at one another, rising uncertainly and dropping down again, restlessly demanding anything but this pause. There was a sound of submerged hysteria in the whispers. They seemed to be waiting to be told what to think. Dr. Stadler saw a woman being escorted down the steps from the back row, her head bent, a handkerchief pressed to her mouth. She was sick at her stomach. He turned away and saw that Dr. Ferris was still watching him. Dr. Stadler leaned back a little, his face austere and scornful, the face of the nation's greatest scientist, and asked, "Who invented that ghastly thing?"
"You did."
Dr. Stadler looked at him, not moving.
"It is merely a practical appliance," said Dr. Ferris pleasantly. "Based upon your theoretical discoveries, it was derived from your invaluable research into the nature of cosmic rays and of the spatial transmission of energy."
"Who worked on the project?"
"A few third-raters, as you would call them. Really, there was very little difficulty. None of them could have begun to conceive of the first step toward the concept of your energy transmission formula, but given that, the rest was easy."
"What is the practical purpose of this invention? What are the epoch-making possibilities?"
"Oh, but don't you see? It is an invaluable instrument of public security. No enemy would attack the possessor of such a weapon. It will set the country free from the fear of aggression and permit it to plan its future in undisturbed safety."
His voice had an odd carelessness, a tone of offhand improvisation, as if he were neither expecting nor attempting to be believed.
"It will relieve social frictions. It will promote peace, stability, and, as we have indicated, harmony. It will eliminate all danger of war."
"What war? What aggression? With the whole world starving and all those people's states barely subsisting on handouts from this country, where do you see any danger of war? Do you expect those ragged savages to attack you?"
Dr. Ferris looked straight into his eyes. "Internal enemies can be as great a danger to the people as external ones," he answered.
"Perhaps greater." This time his voice sounded as if he expected and was certain to be understood.
"Social systems are so precarious. But think of what stability could be achieved by a few scientific installations at strategic key points. It would guarantee a state of permanent peace, don't you think so?"
Dr. Stadler did not move or answer. As the seconds clicked past and his face still held an unchanged expression, it began to look paralyzed. His eyes had the stare of a man who suddenly sees that which he had known from the first, had spent years trying not to see, and who is now engaged in a contest between the sight and his power to deny its existence.
"I don't know what you're talking about," he snapped at last.
Dr. Ferris smiled.
"No private businessman or greedy industrialist would have financed Project X," he said softly, in the tone of an idle, informal discussion. "He couldn't have afforded it. It's an enormous investment with no prospect of material gain. What profit could he expect from it? There are no profits henceforth to be derived from that farm."
He pointed at the dark strip in the distance.
"But, as you have so well observed, Project X had to be a non-profit venture. Contrary to a business firm, the State Science Institute had no trouble in obtaining funds for the project. You have not heard of the Institute having any financial difficulties in the past 2 years, have you? And it used to be such a problem, getting them to vote the funds necessary for the advancement of science. They always demanded gadgets for their cash, as you used to say. Well, here was a gadget which some people in power could fully appreciate. They got the others to vote for it. It wasn't difficult. In fact, a great many of those others felt safe in voting money for a project that was secret. They felt certain it was important, since they were not considered important enough to be let in on it. There were, of course, a few skeptics and doubters, but they gave in when they were reminded that the head of the State Science Institute was Dr. Robert Stadler, whose judgment and integrity they could not doubt."
Dr. Stadler was looking down at his fingernails. The sudden screech of the microphone jerked the crowd into an instantaneous attentiveness. People seemed to be a second's worth of self-control away from panic. An announcer with a voice like a machine gun, spitting smiles, barked cheerily that they were now to witness the radio broadcast that would break the news of the great discovery to the whole nation. Then, with a glance at his watch, his script,
and the signaling arm of Wesley Mooch, he yelled into the sparkling snake head of the microphone, into the living rooms, the offices, the studies, the nurseries of the country. "Ladies and gentlemen, Project X."